Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
Welcome one, welcome all. Thank you for joining us on Double Feature. My name is Eric 13. And look who showed up today. It's Michael Kester.
Oh, it's me. I showed up. That's
Michael
right.
Kester actually came to the show after I somehow managed to get one fucking double feature on the show this year. Yeah, what now? Your score is not looking so hot, is it?
No, you nailed it.
Snuck one right in there.
You got a whole show.
Yeah, I came up with a theme. I found two films. It was very difficult.
You know, let me tell you the most difficult thing on this here podcast of Double Feature. The most difficult thing about coming up with shows, and this is an insider tip for you listeners. The hardest thing is not watching the movies. The hardest thing is not coming up with thematic pairs that are smart and have at least 23 to 25 minutes of conversation. The hardest thing, there isn't even a grain of joking, is convincing the other host that it's a good idea. That's without a doubt the most difficult thing about schedule planning. And you, I have to applaud you. Not only did you convince me that this was a good pair, but you managed to do so despite it having
a really dumb title pun.
Yeah, title pun.
It's a really dumb title.
Title pun is usually like, I know to steer away from it even if it's perfect, because you just won't accept a title pun.
Well, it has to be the best possible one of the year, and then we put it at the end. That's the only allowance for that, and that was not what was going on here. But today, we got Eyes of My Mother and Don't Look Now.
I see what you did there.
Which is a little funny and a little stupid. More stupid than funny, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But the films happen to just go wonderfully together. They talk about a central theme. And I don't know, if I just pretend that I meant to make a dumb title out of it instead of it being an accident that I hate, then it's wonderful. It's a wonderful time. Maybe people on the internet like it. I don't know. We're going to talk about death today. Talk about familial death and the chasm it creates, and we're going to spoil the fuck out of the movies while we do that.
That'd be the plan.
If you don't like spoilers, I've got a great fucking episode, but it's in the additional content.
Mm-hmm.
It's finally out. The additional content, first additional content of year 11, because it's the first time we made our fucking Patreon of year 11.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks for that. If you are on the Patreon, you can get the episode. It is a spoiler-free episode. Looking back, what it ended up kind of being is looking back at the films of the last year of our life off of the show and trying to figure out of everything we saw, because we see way more than goes on the show, is there still transgressive cinema out there? Can films still be dangerous?
Mm-hmm.
And I loved that episode.
Unlikely answer.
Yeah.
Was where that landed.
In fact, even less likely than a yes or a no. Or maybe was the strange area that we seem to gravitate around.
Yeah.
The strange one interesting film, one quick trick that you will not believe on the additional content.
This podcast says one amazing thing that you would not believe. And what happens next will surprise you.
What happens next is I got to see that movie again, because you still feel the way you felt on that show?
Definitely.
Yeah, I do too. Weird, right? Super.
Maybe
fucking
more
weird.
So.
Oh
maybe
my god,
just
it's
like
crazy.
Doubled down.
You know what's funny though is without spoiling the show, we have been getting some feedback from patrons on the Patreon, and they have been saying, "Well, there's a little debate." Some have been saying, "You know what? You're right," and some are like, "The fuck you talking about?" So there's a hot debate up there on the Double Feature Patreon. It's patreon.com/. Double Feature. Because it's a new month, we're once again missing a bunch of Patreons. Some die every month. That is the downside of joining the Patreon. It is cursed.
I know.
And 10%
of you will... We try to live alone on a farm with their corpses, but...
Okay,
there's only so many Patreons to keep the farm going.
I see what you're doing. It's time to get into some of these goddamn movies. Thank you, Michael, for watching these movies.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to sit through them again.
I wanted to start with Eyes of My Mother. This was a movie that I came to really late because it was the year prior to paying attention to any festivals.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a movie that I just secretly have so much career jealousy of for a couple reasons. One, it did like gangbusters. It just did great. But the other is that it's just such a smart way to take very little resources. Here's the thing that's consuming my life. We never talk about this on the show, but if you got a little bit of money, you can scrap together Rodriguez style and make an Evil Dead horror movie. You run out in the woods with your friends. You point the camera at stuff that needs to happen plot point wise in your movie. You make a film. It's very hard to make a nuanced or sophisticated film with subtext that still hits with very little money.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple cheats that can kind of get you in that zone. But you have to be, you have to have some guts to do them because they will make your film much less popular. Those cheats are subtitles and black and whites. And I just, knowing those things and looking at it, I just don't have the courage. And this dude did. And good on him because, and it worked.
Yes, it did.
It was a Sundance 2016 film, and then it basically played every fucking festival, Chicago, Edmonton, like AFI, the whole gamut.
This movie is interesting because to kind of touch on a conversation that we had on the additional content, it's a movie that will easily turn off an audience that's not prepared for it. And something, a conversation we had on the second Human Centipede show,
uh-huh.
We did the second Human Centipede,
also an art house black and white.
Well, and that's what I mean is there is a certain caliber of filmmaking that forces your audience to stay sitting even when you do something that you or I would still acknowledge is pretty fucked up.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's a version of film where you have sort of a more standard drama and something fucked up happens, and that's more or less, it's kind of a big piece in the film, and maybe it's sort of a tableau, but it's rarely, well, two things. One, it's rarely super graphic. It's usually hinted at.
Mm-hmm.
And two, it's not the first thing that happens in your movie.
Yeah.
This film out of the gate basically dares you to keep watching, but it manages to have this sort of cadence that by the time the big thing happens at the beginning, where you have a rape, murder, torture, the whole, I mean, like basically your checklist of fucked up shit happens within the first 15 minutes, and it's fucked up. It's a fucked up version of the fucked up shit.
Right.
So I just want to be very clear, but the film basically dares you at that point. It has taken that much time to prove that it's not doing it superfluously, and it's not just trying to be exploitative. Is it exploitative? Absolutely. I mean, definitely. It definitely goes over the top from where I would say it would need to go to make its point.
Yeah.
But in being so graphic, I think that forces the film to stand out, which is rad.
Yeah, it's some of our favorite things about the French extreme movies.
Exactly.
It's those places that, and those really, you know, I think those do a lot more. You're kind of not a French extreme movie unless you do more than you can get away with.
Right.
You know, like that's sort of where you have to live. And that's the thing that really, we can talk about all the stuff thematically or the craftsmanship of Eyes of My Mother, but the part that really impresses me is that it still looks like a very tonally serious, a movie that does the things it's doing by necessity, that it really thinks with each decision, it would be a lesser movie if it wasn't so extreme in those specific places. I think that this is also going to be interesting. This is, it's Nicholas Pesce, I think is how you pronounce his last name. It's P-E-S-C-E. He has another movie coming out called Piercing. And actually, if it happens this year, The Grudge reboot.
Mm-hmm.
So after this thing came out and like played for an entire year and then came out in December where everybody could see it, follows up with two films immediately after that. And I think those are going to be the movies that start to answer the questions about, you know, what is superfluous, right?
Sure.
How much really needs to be there? Because the other great part is that there's an enigmatic quality about things in Eyes of My Mother,
mm-hmm.
where most of the people I talk to about this movie scratch their head a bit at the end and sort of go, oh yeah, that guy was working on some stuff. But not often are they going, all right, here's why this happened at this degree, you know, at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those probably aren't things we can answer, certainly without seeing other of the director's work and other things he's written. But, you know, we can start to open that. I mean, it's a movie about loss, right? You described the scene in the beginning. And that loss creates a great kind of loneliness in this character that we're following. But she's also sort of fucked up.
Yeah.
I think if we look at this as a movie like May, right? Mm-hmm. Where we go, there's something a little off about this girl.
Mm-hmm.
And a little less maybe trying to solve why that is, because I think that's a lot of what people get hung up in before ultimately shrugging and going, I don't know what the fuck was going on in there.
Right.
You know, you could start to break down a lot of what transpires in the movie if you're not always looking for the why. Why does she turn to violent ends, you know, where a normal person might just sit at home, watch TV and cry, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
There's that moment in the beginning with the, you know, a lot of that surrounds that guy in the shed and sort of the fucked up French moments, let's say, around that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying not to just like get stuck in a place where I'm talking about how gorgeous the brutality is, because we know from the Hostel episodes that doesn't,
right,
how those conversations go. But, you know, she has that moment where she talks to the guy and she says, why would I kill you? You're my only friend.
Mm-hmm.
And I think thematically, that's so much of the movie. You know, we see...
Sure.
We only see a couple of relationships with her. We see the stuff with her mother and the weird, like, animal stuff in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the man in the shed, who is such a large body of the film. But the two bits that, to me, fill in so much of who this character is and are so interesting are her relationship with her dad after her mother passes.
Mm-hmm.
And that encounter she has with the girl.
Right.
The stuff with her dad is really interesting to me because it's so, I don't know, I'm curious how this reads to you. But to me, when I see, you know, the way her dad reacts to what happened to her mom, we have sort of a set of, like when we talked about Dogtooth,
mm-hmm.
earlier in the year,
mm-hmm.
we talked about the family dynamic and figuring out like what was fucked up or who's responsible for the fucked up or whatever. So we see this girl's parents, we see a fine relationship with her mom. When her mom goes away and her dad's there, I'm trying to sort of judge the grief of her dad and how he attempts to, you know, they kind of try to keep each other company, but to me, it doesn't feel like father-daughter anymore.
Right.
You know?
Sure.
He feels cold and they feel like peers that aren't connecting.
Right.
There's
no, that's
like
true.
The stuff where he's trying to watch TV, you know, or the, like when they're dancing,
mm-hmm.
and it's just such a, it just feels fucking empty. As if they're trying to exist as peers and it's just not there.
Right.
But I don't know. I also have trouble reading family relationships, so I don't know what your take on that is.
No, I mean, I think you're right. I think that the role of the father in the film is to make sure to display like one very obvious reaction to such a grave loss.
Mm.
Which is to just entirely withdraw and vanish.
Yeah.
And I think it's important in the context of this movie because you need to see somebody do that so that you don't think that that's what she's doing.
Yeah, right.
Because she's more like in an arrested development state, but it's not withdrawal. She's still attempting to be an active member of the world, you know, exist in the world. Whereas the dad is doing everything within his power to not exist in the world anymore. He has no desire.
Yeah, right.
To exist in the world.
Yeah, I think we see that too with the girl.
Right.
Right. As she brings that girl home, then we start to see, all right, well, how does she interact with another person? You know, here's somebody, okay, it really is her peer.
Mm-hmm.
And they have that very stilted sort of lack of connection.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first time I think we can get, you know, again, to go back to that fucking Dogtooth episode, or we've talked about this in a lot of different movies, not having the audience surrogate, you know, makes it really hard to tell. In all the Yorgos movies, that's sort of how it is. We just don't have any ability to tell like what's normal and what's not. Because she is off in this fucking cottage and it really could be any year.
Right.
You know, if that girl had whipped out a cell phone in the scene, it would have surprised me, but not that much.
Right.
Or if, you know, it just lives in the space like outside of time. So she's off in seclusion. She's bringing somebody home from a bar. It immediately feels like we're no longer on planet Eraserhead. Now we at least have a place where we can, okay, there are other humans in this world. And this human goes, oh, you're freaking me the fuck out. You know,
right?
What's wrong here? Does that wonderful little bit going to the phone.
Right.
And when she picks up the phone, and this is usually, you know, usually such a throwaway scene to go like, oh, she went to get help, but the line's disconnected or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like she doesn't even use the phone. It's not even registered. It doesn't even operate as a phone.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives you a little bit of that. I mean, I think it's kind of obvious for a piece of subtext, but it's great that it's there. It tells you something in this sort of cat and mouse beat of, oh no, she can't get away. But it also tells you like, this girl's not even talking to people on the phone.
Right.
She goes nowhere. She converses with no one. And in a movie that has to be so so kind of economic with its time, it has to do so much in such a short period. It tells you right away between these different eras of her life, like there just isn't anyone.
Mm-hmm.
This girl from the bar might be the first time. That was my impression. Is that's like the first time she's really gone out to speak to a person, maybe since the last person we saw.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to go back and talk about that gore for a minute, just because double feature, and I can't stop myself. The you know, the other thing that I think about some of the brutality in this that really makes it work is a piece of just the. I go back to a word like craftsmanship, right? It's the way that it's shown to you in just such a smart little delivery. This film has a couple different techniques for what it's showing you. You're right. It's pretty top loaded.
Mm-hmm.
You remember not just the thing in the shed, but you remember what we see right before the shed is, maybe this doesn't register in your mind as gore. I don't know, but it's like a butchering of an animal.
Oh no. Yeah.
Right.
No, that doesn't ever. That it's funny because to me, I feel like in a lot of cinematic settings, they use the butchering of animals to kind of be like symbolic violence.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why, but for me, it never land. Like, I mean, fucking Silence of the Lambs, quintessentially.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but for me, it just has never. Or what's the movie with the butcher guy?
Midnight Meat Train.
Sure, but no.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Closer, but definitely more foreign.
You've seen The Butcher.
What's it called? I Stand Alone?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
the
yeah.
The Gaspar Noé movie? What's the Gaspar Noé movie?
Yeah.
Yeah. I know, you thought it was just a Godsmack song.
Yeah, that's what I was getting to.
Anyway, but yes, I'm able to watch a scene like that and go, ah, this is symbolic violence. But what's insane is that it's actual violence.
Well, yeah, it's pretty gnarly. And also that bit of mutilation that I think brings her a little closer to her mother. So, you know, there's this one time that we really get to see them together. Most notably that sticks out, and it's such a nasty scene. What I meant about the craftsmanship is just, you know, so you get that beat early on just so the movie tells you it can.
Mm-hmm.
Just so it goes, just so you know, this is going to be fucking tough. And it leaves you alone for a little while. But when it's the cut, it's the editing. This movie makes these abrupt cuts. It's constantly bordering on smash cuts. I don't know if it's totally there, how you want to call that. But when you know how a scene is going to play out, the movie just says, fuck it, move on. Again, it goes back to that time economy.
Mm-hmm.
There's some of the violence. When you're watching a scene and you know something violent's going to happen and a movie flirts with it, it puts a thing too close to a person's eyeball.
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone starts scratching around on a face or something. That's certainly one way you can get audiences really wiggling in the seat. I think the meaner way is to skip that part and show the violence before they have time to not look at it.
Sure.
Like, we don't really see that as much, but instead of fucking around, you know, scratching at an eye and never putting a thing through it, you just cut right to a thing going through an eye.
Sure.
Before people even know where they are.
Sure.
And then they're kind of watching something that they didn't even have a chance right. to look away from.
Kind of like that very exciting first cut in It Follows. You go, yeah, ooh, what's totally, this creepy totally. Thing? Okay, wow, I guess that's what's happening.
Yeah. Excuse me, weren't you going to warn me, movie?
Yeah.
And of course, this is such a fitting device for a movie like Eyes of My Mother. No, it's not going to warn you. And you could even make a, you know, a sort of symbolic link into the plot of the film with that. But I just think if you're going to do a gruesome movie and not give, you know, just invade people's lives, then you fucking, you know, you go full for it. But I think there's even spots where it does have a moment to kind of scratch around the eye before it plunges through. It just does it in a different context. So like the dancing in front of the father scene,
mm-hmm.
not with him, but later in front of him. And the movie kind of lures you into a trance. It lingers there and there's a rhythm to it and a pace. And then it cuts to something that you just would have fucking looked away from. And it catches you even more off guard because it's not a random cut to this thing. Like say, you know, maybe something like the nail scene, you know, later that you just don't know it's going to go there. But this is, it lures you into this false sense of relaxing and gets you in a place so that it can then, when it punches you in the face, which it always knows it's going to do, it can do it a little bit harder.
Mm-hmm.
Because I am a dark, twisted individual, I just really enjoy movies fucking with people. So I think that's probably why I like that. But the temperature of that violence, the tone of the violence is, it's not just the, you know, the fucking with the audience. I also feel like there's a lyrical quality to that violence that fits into the themes of the story too. If we just keep going back all the time, and we'll see this a bit in Don't Look Now, but if we go back to this over and over as a movie about loneliness or trying to connect or these misplaced pieces of affection, I think you even see that in how some of the violence comes out. You know, every time we see the really nasty, stitchy kind of stuff, it's always done in this very loving, maternal sure. sort of way.
Sure.
It's cradle this guy's head, you know, as his eyeballs go missing between the edit.
Mm-hmm.
There's always like a nursing quality to it.
Sure.
And then even when he's running away in the super wide later, that bone tomahawk, you know, mm-hmm. go from ultra wide to immediate close up, which is just like nasty and cool. When it comes back in from that ultra wide to do the stab, it's like a slow sensual stabbing.
Right.
Which is totally. Really fucked up. Yeah. It's like this sort of loving. She
it's like a favor.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. Well, it sort of reads like she's fuck stabbing him yeah. or something. It's just like this weird, creepy off camera. And you know, if they'd shown it more on camera, it would be more deliberate in what she's doing. But it almost seems like a strange, it's somewhere between, like sensual is a good word, I guess, but it's like a, somewhere between a platonic favor or something more like lovingly maternal or something more of a lover. You know, there's like some weird sort of sexuality to it.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's happening off the frame, we all know what's happening. It's just a stabbing motion. But because it happens off the frame, I think it kind of adds to that additional,
mm-hmm.
like, what is she doing with her hand? And why does it feel so gross and weird and like comforting in some strange way? When a movie gets away with doing all of this stuff, those are the things that I'm always left thinking. And then I never manage to get to the what does it all mean of it.
Right.
And thankfully on Double Feature, we don't either because we're out of time.
I mean, so I was actually going to ask you a question because Don't Look Now is a movie that, I don't know, we talk all the time about where we come up with the movies to watch because there's an infinite amount of movies. And I don't know about you. Tell me if this happens to you, but like if you go on a streaming service, like I want to say Shudder, but it's way too much in our wheelhouse and it's harder for me for Shudder because I will watch garbage on Shudder willingly.
Uh-huh.
But like if you go to, I don't know, Vudu and you have this ability to, you can just look at the entire scroll and someone goes, ooh, what's this? And you can just like off the top of your head, you're like, it's garbage. I know for a fact it's garbage. For example, there was this, I'm going through one of the streaming services and person I was watching it with was like, ooh, what's this? It's called like 2036 Andromeda. And I'm like, it's garbage. I don't care.
Yeah.
And she's like, I really like sci-fi. I'm like, you won't like this. Yeah. I have never heard of it, right. But I know it's trash. And so it's definitely gotten to the point for me where like, I'm pretty good at picking a movie that I will at least moderately enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not horror, I will actively disenjoy watching a horror movie from start to finish before I'll turn it off.
Yeah.
But other genres.
You know when I usually turn off a terrible horror movie is once all of the credits are over.
Right. Sure. With the exception being like really bad Lawnmower Man CG.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes I can't make it through.
All right. So where are you going with this?
My point is Don't Look Now on Flickchart for a long time was like the highest rated horror movie that I hadn't seen.
Oh, really?
Forever.
Yeah.
And by the time I finally got it, I kept trying to think I would watch it for 20 or for 31 days of horror.
Mm-hmm.
And then deciding it wasn't horror enough.
Michael does 22 days of horror because he's a realist. He's honest with himself.
So I finally get around to watching it. And I was right. It's not really a horror movie. Is it horrifying? Definitely. Mm-hmm. Very horrifying. But kind of the antithesis of Eyes of My Mother. I feel like this is one of those things. And I think you and I talk about this every once in a while. It's a good gateway horror movie because it handles a lot of the themes of our favorite genre without betraying somebody who's not willing to watch a horror movie.
Well, it's got that British flair for sure. So right Absolutely. Away we're dealing with that. We're definitely in more Rosemary's Baby territory.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, you know, it's 1973. And this was also a movie that went for a long time. You know, we're doing it on the show. I'd seen it for the first time on the show. And if you've ever, God, especially if you're new to the show, you have a lot of these fucking people in your life. But if you've ever felt bad that, you know, you say, oh, I've never seen X movie. And someone goes, you've never seen X movie.
Oh my God, that's my entire fucking life.
And this happens all the time, right? It happens with
me. It's my entire life.
It's a lot less now, but I still
somebody just said, they showed me some article about like celebrating 10 years of Ratatouille being the perfect movie. And I was like, oh, I've never seen Ratatouille.
Okay, right. Yeah, but you know, and I used to get really upset by that, but then Don't Look Now happened and no human in my life has ever said to me, you've never seen Don't Look Now, and I really wish someone would have fucking done that.
Right.
Because it's so unbelievably right in my wheelhouse of just mm-hmm. like, it sits on the edge of the genre. It's got a European flavor. Right. It's just
I know.
Brimming with extra junk to talk about.
Right. It's just like Repulsion without the hands out the walls.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like more nuanced, you know, more nuanced Repulsion, which is basically just sitting in a girl's apartment while she starves to death, eating things that are rotting in her fridge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's those are the places that I hang out. And the fact that none of my friends showed me this actually disappoints me a little bit. The magic of Don't Look Now for me is twofold. One is that it has this deep concern with grief and the fallout of that, and everything else serves that. It does nothing else. It doesn't care about anything else, even to the point, like you were saying, that it feels less like horror because mm-hmm. it doesn't even care about the spooks. It just right. cares about
the Sutherland.
It's going, what has grief done? That in its, it feels like it's operating with this premise that goes, grief is horrifying. And as long as you believe that, we're making a horror movie and we do whatever we need to serve that premise.
Mm-hmm.
But it also tries to show these different ways that the horror can be caused by that. That you can, you know, when it's showing these people unravel, it's showing the psychological damage to them, and that's manifesting in these sort of haunting type things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's like clairvoyance around, there's some funeral stuff going around.
Right. No, I get it. It's a fucking Giallo movie. I get it. I'm there. Yeah. I'm right there with you.
There's a fixation on some items. So that's the first thing. But the other thing is that it's a movie that's so straightforward and so simple in its plot, but it's extremely complex in how rich its themes are. You know, the whole movie is just, what can we do with this idea of grief? Like, how do we just milk the fuck out of that? And you remember when you were going through, you know, lit classes, English classes or whatever in school, and you're talking about, I don't know, if you went to not a bad school system like I did, maybe you'd talk more about subtext or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you talk about subtext, you talk about metaphor, you talk about what it's saying that it's not saying directly, or maybe if you really go deep, you talk about things that are happening in the world at the time. What do the surface events mean more symbolically? And I feel like every different avenue you could pursue with that, Don't Look Now goes down, and it uses that to kind of create this haunting in the real world. It's stuff that, you know, is fun to pick at for the questions that we've long had about when a movie does something symbolically, is it feeding into what it's saying, or is it creating just this sort of like neat red herring?
Sure.
Like some of that Giallo stuff we've talked about, okay, you focus on an item. Do you focus on the item for the plot or because the item evokes something? Or does the director just really like that fucking item so that thing is around all the time?
Mm-hmm.
And Don't Look Now kind of has these two different pieces where there's sort of backdrop and tapestry and just the tone of the film, things that happen in this film that give it some identity. And then there are themes that are a lot deeper to what's actually going on.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of going through and trying to figure some of that stuff out, get your brain working on the problem and puts you in that position of the grief or accentuates that. You know, I don't know, where are they, like Venice or something?
Yeah.
So there's all the religious stuff, right?
Sure.
He's like working on a church and there's these conversations with religious figures. And that kind of stuff I feel like is backdrop. I don't know how much that plays into the grief, especially because plot-wise, they don't go to the religious figures to go, help me, I'm dealing with grief. They go there to be like, yo, this building, do you want me to move the windows over or what do you want over here?
Mm-hmm.
And the dude's just like, I don't want to talk to you about windows. I want to talk to you about elaborate existential metaphors. But then there's stuff like the water. You know, you have this serial killer Jell-O was such a good such a good pick for this. There's like a Jell-O subplot going on in the film. You know,
no,
like
I know.
They're trying
I know.
They're trying to like Argento's shooting a movie and there's like two people on the set who have had this terrible thing happen in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like BTS of that going on the whole fucking time.
Yeah.
But the serial killer is like his victims.
No, this is definitely in, this is definitely the Saw 5 to Argento's Repo.
Totally. To Argento's Repo. He just dropped a bunch of references like only somebody listening to this show for 11 fucking years would have any clue.
Or
like that.
Somebody who listens to that show religiously that gives to patreon.com/double feature will understand.
There it is. Yeah, you haven't put your money in the hat in the collection bin for this month if you don't understand Michael's elaborate Argento meets Repo meets fucking whatever references. But you know, it's kind of funny. It's like the even the serial killer stuff is it's not painful because, oh my God, a serial killer might get us. It's painful because the serial killer is a fucking reminder that they lost their kid, you know, when they should be running away from whatever the fuck the thing is that stabs him to death at the end of the movie. They're not concerned about that at all. They're concerned with like the haunting and undoing from the loss of the child. When they pull that corpse out of the water, the fact that there's a corpse coming out of the water is not concerning so much as, oh no, the reminder of a dead body in water.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the things that Don't Look Now pokes at where, you know, the same way that we talk about triggers today in relation to trauma.
There we go.
What if your trigger was an incident around fucking water? It's like you can't even have a drink at dinner without being reminded of your dead child and fainting. Everywhere you look, there's just fucking water around you all the time. Don't Look Now builds this whole world that is just a person's fucking trauma and their hangups and their inability to go anywhere or do anything. It's like having a breakup and then every song you hear is a fucking breakup song. You just can't get rid of it. It makes the world really, really oppressive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a cool thing for symbolism to do is what if the symbols aren't just, you know, little enigmas or little mysteries to be solved or pieced together? But what if people are throwing fucking symbols at you all the time and you're just like, enough with the symbols, leave me alone. I'm trying to build my church or whatever the fuck I do. And, you know, then somebody chucks a, I don't know, a red raincoat at you and you fall off your scaffolding. You know what I mean? What's going on with the accidental falling in this movie? What's the deal with the whole like... Is this part of the tapestry?
You mean the day-to-day pitfalls of grief?
Well, I mean like, okay, so when we talk about these things that the movie just likes to do versus, you know, all the red in the movie, right? The movie just going, let's use red to remind the audience of this or to invoke it in some kind of way versus the more tangible like... You know, in the Dogma 95 rules, God, let's really get out there, right? In the Dogma 95 rules, you have that music that has to come from a source that you're looking at within the film, you know?
Yes, I love that rule.
So if a song comes on, you know the characters are listening to it. It's not being played like on a tape cassette outside the fourth wall.
Right.
So that's kind of how I think about the symbols in this movie. I go, you know, I don't think the family sees red. Maybe red's not a good example, but like, okay, so water, I know they see water and they think about water within the context of what's happening to them.
Mm-hmm.
But like all this fucking falling, you know, they warn, there's a premonition or whatever. They warn the father of danger. And then there's kind of the fake out where you think that maybe the danger is that he was going to fall off the thing. That's what they're warning him about. But you know, he's falling, she's fainting. There's however the kid wound up in the water to begin with. Do you the son's accident at the school comes from a fall? Like, okay, so here's a good example then. So when they hear that their son's accident comes from a fall, are they going, oh no, falling? Or is this just like a thing that the movie, in this movie, there's just always falling and it doesn't, the characters aren't, do the characters wake up going, we should really get like falling insurance?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying though, right?
Yeah, no, I totally do. Yeah. You're,
like,
you're,
are these the concerns in the world?
Well, yeah, you're wondering, you're, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're kind of asking whether or not the characters see the theme of falling in their lives.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Or whether or not the film has imbued a thematic falling over the characters.
Right. Right.
But to them, one fall is immediately overtaken by the next immediate fall, and they don't necessarily recall the repeated falls throughout their life.
Totally. Totally. Because that's how I sort these, right? That's how I sort in this movie specifically between symbols that matter as texture of the movie and symbols that matter to the characters' lives.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's just so much of that. There's like all the mistaken identity stuff and doubles, which feeds into like the horror of everyday life type stuff, which feeds into the sort of psychological unraveling. It kind of illustrates that. But then there's way broader stuff like the premonition. I think the premonition's more on, more is like a theme of the entire movie down to the fucking title.
Mm-hmm.
So all this clairvoyance and stuff, I mean, what is premonition if not the, you know, the ability to see when you can't actually see? So I think that's just like a dark thing that mocks the characters. It's literally just, if your child had died as a result of an accident, I think you're probably cursing yourself for not being there when it happened,
sure.
Right?
Right,
you're
right.
Probably going like, I should have been watching.
Yeah.
And in a movie called Don't Look Now, I mean, isn't that the fucking tie, right? Like, I don't think I have to really make a case for that. I think that's kind of a pretty deliberate thing. But all the other mistaken identity and all of that starts to feed into this lack of proper communication and the anxiety and frustration of getting the mother and father to deal with the grief and the loss rather than to just let it undo them and drive them into this insanity.
Mm-hmm.
Because that kind of frustration or confusion, it seems like every time a bad thing happens in this movie, it's kind of a result of some weird confusion or some like people aren't talking, people aren't, I don't want to say not paying attention, but they're like, it didn't have to happen. If God, it's almost got a Kafka thing. I think about like, okay, you remember that scene where there seems to be so much of this movie, they're just running around in these like fucking smoke-filled corridors and alleys and stuff. They mm-hmm. can't figure out like where the fuck they're going. Or these great things with Sutherland's character where like the only word, he's trying to restore a whole church and seemingly only able to say yes in Italian. That's like the only fucking word he knows.
Right.
You know, he's trying to communicate with these other people.
Well, he learned that because he constantly tried to end conversations and then realized every time he said bye, they would just keep speaking.
So there is an element of being like almost in a place where you don't know the language. I think that's the feeling of being in that relationship too, is getting lost in these smoke-filled labyrinths of not knowing where the fuck you're going. And I feel like maybe the movie starts from there. It starts from, what does it feel like to have grief in this way? You're so blindsided. It's like none of your decisions matter and you're going to wind up getting lost in labyrinths in the back alleys.
Right.
No matter what, nothing makes sense. It just feeds a lot more into Kafka than I think I realized, you know, the first time I was going through and watching it, which gives people no answers. Just,
well, that's the
makes everybody crazy.
That's my favorite thing about Franz Kafka, is that to expect an answer is to be disappointed.
Yeah, yeah. I want to thank the Patreons for hanging out with us. I want to thank the listeners. But I was attempting to gear up to a list that I, believe it or not, don't need to vamp. Sounds like I'm vamping. Don't need to vamp. Here it is. Abbott of Unreason, Ben Ecker, Brett Hayton, Charles Crawford, John, Mark Abbott, and Tom Leonard. If it sounds like we're one executive producer short, we definitely are. It's patreon.com/doublefeature. really sorry one of our executive producers died because of the curse of fucking Kathy's ghost or whatever.
Someone else can just fall right into that gap.
Much appreciated. All right. You've put up with enough of my spooky, lonely bullshit. What are we doing next time?
Next time we have mandatory show. So
mandatory show. That's my favorite episode.
Love mandatory show.
I know where we are.
It's mandatory show time. Next time on Double Feature, what show number is it?
This is show number 549, which means we've got a couple mandatory shows coming up.
Yeah, there you go.
It is time to return once again to our Disney and Hammer journey.
Right, the Disney Hammer. Not to be confused with Thor's Hammer, which is the current Disney Hammer.
Right, also a Disney Hammer, yeah.
So we're going to do a movie that I've kind of been excited about doing since we started this journey, which is The Black Cauldron, which has less to do with witches than a film called The Witches, which is the Hammer film we're doing.
So Black Cauldron is 85, and The Witches is 1966, not to be confused with the Black Phillip Witch.
Right.
Also, don't run a DuckDuckGo search for The Witch's Hammer.
Right.
Thinking that you can cheat Hammer Horror out of the title, because The Witch's Hammer is also literally the name of a film.
Great.
So
cool.
There's all the things we're not doing.
So everybody preheat your ovens for next week, because
terrible. You're awful. Banned from the internet.
And to that end, watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.